This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Coming up, we'll have a segment from our interview last year with Ryan Weber, who became the director of the Kalamazoo Public Library in August. But first, a headline on a recent article by Bill Hartung says that 2018 looks like an arms bonanza. And the director of the Arms and Security Project at the Center for International Policy would tell you that topping the spending on arms in previous years is no small feat. Bill Hartung will speak on Wednesday night in the chapel room at First Congregational Church in Kalamazoo. His presentation is called Perpetual War, Massive Human and Economic Costs of the Corporate Grip on the Pentagon Budget. It is sponsored by Kalamazoo Nonviolent Opponents of War. Bill Hartung, thank you very much for being with us.
Yes, thanks for having me.
Let's start by going back to the fall of 2016. We'll obviously get into what President Trump has been doing in a little bit. But if we were sitting there having this conversation in October of 2016, while President Obama was still in office coming to the end of his second term, what would we say about the state of what we call the military-industrial complex?
You know, during the State of the Union, there's always a line that says, you know, the State of the Union is strong or something like that. And I think, you know, even under Obama, the military-industrial complex was doing quite well because, you know, there was, in 2010, the largest Pentagon budget since World War II was achieved during the first Obama term, and that was moderated slightly by the budget caps that were passed around that time, but it was still at historically high levels, you know, higher than Vietnam or Korea or many other high points in Pentagon spending over the years. And there were robust programs for things like the F-35, which Lockheed Martin builds, the most expensive weapons program in the history of the Pentagon. There was the big nuclear modernization program, which is supposed to spend something like $1.7 trillion over 30 years to build new nuclear submarines and new bombers and new land-based ballistic missiles. The Navy was getting significant sums for things like the littoral combat ship, which is supposed to operate close to shore and support incursions into areas where terrorists or guerrillas are being dealt with. So things were going reasonably well for the complex, although the Pentagon and the companies always want more. So they were complaining about the caps, and they were talking about they needed more money for readiness, training, and maintenance, and so forth. But a lot of that was, I think, just the usual bureaucracies, you know. The Pentagon's never going to say, you know, give us less. And so I viewed it sort of in those terms.
Which then brings us to, of course, the election of Donald Trump in 2016. And he is, of course, sworn into office then January 20th, 2017. As we sit here and talk roughly a year later, what can we say about what has happened under President Trump related to military spending?
Well, it's interesting. In the transition, he actually called out some of the companies for overcharging the government, in his mind, on things like the F-35 combat aircraft and the presidential aircraft and so forth. And so the industry was a little concerned about, you know, who is this guy and, you know, how are we going to have a working relationship with him. But then his first budget called for a $54 billion increase in the Pentagon, which was a huge sum. It's as large as the whole military budgets of allies like Japan or Germany or the UK. So just our increase, you know, would have made us the largest military spender in Europe or right up there with the others. And it was in line with a call to cut domestic programs accordingly, dollar for dollar. So, you know, things like social service block grants, certain kind of health programs, but also deep cuts at the State Department, Department of Environmental Protection, Occupational Safety and Health Administration, and so forth. So it was a little starker contrast than during the Obama years, where there wasn't that kind of, you know, very direct trade-off. And also, very early on, President Trump decided to push foreign arms sales, partly in his view as a jobs program, you know, a way to adjust the trade balance. And when he went to Saudi Arabia early last year, he claimed to have assembled a $110 billion arms sale, which ended up being exaggerated once we looked at the details. But certainly that's his goal, is to increase arms sales. And he's now going to give instructions to our diplomats and military attaches around the world to make helping U.S. companies sell arms part and parcel of their responsibilities as government officials. So the only thing I will say, though, is that Obama made record arms sales. So Trump has this intent, and he's very vocal about it, but it may well take him some doing to outdo the already ample sales that happened by his predecessor.
But is that what led you to write the article with the headline that 2018 looks like an arms bonanza?
Yes, because this is when the Trump increase will come to be. You know, they debate the next year's budget starting in February of the prior year. So Congress has been having a hard time coming to agreement, and they've just done these resolutions that keep things at last year's level. But now the Trump increase and probably tens of billions of dollars more added by Congress will start coming out of the pipeline later this month or early February. So the companies will really see the results of the Trump buildup. And he's also got some commitments, like he wants to build a 350-ship Navy, which would be a huge increase from where we are now. He wants to accelerate the nuclear weapons buildup that was already well underway under President Obama. And as I said, he wants to, you know, expand arms sales to the extent that that's possible. And there's also some moves to loosen the rules on Pentagon weapons purchasing, which could make it easier for companies to charge more, to perhaps get away with more shoddy practices than if they were more carefully monitored. So all of this works well for the industry, which is already, some of them have record stock prices, some of the big companies, some of them have had record revenues. There's companies like Raytheon, which are running three shifts to produce things like cruise missiles. You know, so 2017 was not at all a bad year. A lot of that was really a result of prior budgets passed by Obama. And now this will be the first big year where the Trump increases really benefit the industry.
On the subject of selling arms to other countries, whatever problems that come with that, might there be a lot of voters, members of the public who prefer selling arms to other countries as opposed to getting our own troops involved, boots on the ground, et cetera?
Well, I think that's been a rationale that's been stated. You know, you sell arms, you do training, perhaps you spend a few special forces rather than something like the Bush intervention in Iraq and Afghanistan, where you had hundreds of thousands of U.S. troops overseas in harm's way. So I think there's an argument for that. I think the problem is we're not selective enough. You know, we have arms sales relationships with over 100 countries, more than half the countries in the world, and some of them use those weapons for quite destructive purposes, like Saudi Arabia is doing a bombing campaign and blockade of Yemen using U.S. weapons, and that's caused the biggest humanitarian crisis in the world. You know, thousands of civilians killed in bombing raids, a cholera epidemic, some millions of people on the verge of famine. So, you know, sometimes our allies use these weapons in ways that don't benefit our security and don't benefit the people of their regions. And so that's, I think, the biggest challenge is, okay, if you're going to sell weapons so that these countries will carry out objectives that you would otherwise do yourself, you can't always control how they in fact use the weapons.
So, as I said, you're here to coming to Kalamazoo to talk about the massive human and economic costs of the corporate grip on the Pentagon budget. In terms of those economic costs, do we have a good way of measuring and quantifying what is truly the cost in sheer dollars of, you know, having run multiple wars now for over a decade?
Well, there's a very good project at Brown University called the Cost of War Project, which I've advised on periodically. And their most recent estimate, which they released in a conference with Senator Jack Reed, who's the ranking Democrat on Senate Armed Services, found that the cost of the post-9/11 wars now amount to $5.6 trillion, which is many times more than the amount that is in the Budget Control Act that is supposed to be cut from the deficit. It's about three times that. So it's a huge amount of money that could do a lot of good if it had been put to other purposes. And it combines the direct cost of the wars, you know, paying to send the troops and for the weapons, and to give military aid to allies who are also fighting alongside U.S. troops in those wars. But it also looks at longer-term costs, like the cost of taking care of veterans of those conflicts. And there's been, you know, large numbers, hundreds of thousands of vets with post-traumatic stress syndrome or traumatic brain injuries or, of course, other bodily harm, you know, losing limbs and so forth. So that we need to take care of them for the rest of their lives, and we have to do it well. And so that's going to cost money. And I think their estimate for that piece of it is about $1 trillion. So I think the lesson from their report is that often when we go into a conflict, there's the estimate put out there, and it's inevitably many times smaller than what the actual cost of fighting the war ends up being.
If the American public were presented with a more accurate estimate of what a war is going to cost, economically as well, in terms of the human cost, as you mentioned, you know, people who come back from these wars and have long-term chronic injuries, they need care for the rest of their lives. And then, of course, there's the people who don't come home at all. Do you think that if that were spelled out better, there might be less support and less enthusiasm at a time when America is talking about engaging in some sort of military action?
I do. I think if people had a full sense of the economic costs and also the costs, you know, to our military personnel, and of course the trade-offs of things that we don't invest in here, you know, whether it's infrastructure or healthcare or education or protecting the environment, a lot of people don't see that as a direct connection, but in the environment we're in, where we've got a huge tax cut and there's not going to be as many revenues, that friction between domestic versus Pentagon spending is going to be much stronger than it's been in recent years. So I do think people would be more reluctant to support interventions. And I mean, even, you know, during Donald Trump's campaign, he was very harsh about the Iraq war, you know, that it cost trillions of dollars. It was a disaster. We should have invested that money at home. And he hasn't followed that script now that he's president. But I think that was a part of his appeal during the campaign, indicating that there are probably people across the spectrum who are at least war weary. You know, I don't think they would support a major deployment of the kind, you know, the hundreds of thousands of troops that were in Iraq and Afghanistan in the prior administration. So I think already there's a little bit of that, and I think it might grow, that sort of skepticism about the value of the use of force.
Is the money which is spent on defense and any calls for scaling that back, is the call for scaling that back seen in some ways as undermining the troops? And if so, is that an accurate assessment?
I don't think so. I mean, first of all, 40 to 50% of the Pentagon budget goes right back out the door to corporations like Lockheed Martin and Northrop Grumman and Raytheon, General Dynamics, and others. And some of what they build is not particularly helpful to the troops. So if they make something like the F-35, which some analysts say may never be ready for combat, as well as being a hugely expensive weapon that crowds out other investments, that's not necessarily helpful to the troops in the field. Likewise, the new buildup of nuclear weapons is massive overkill. We already have more than enough to dissuade any country from attacking us. So that doesn't help the troops. It doesn't pay them. It doesn't equip them. It doesn't help them fight the most urgent threats like ISIS and other things. So, you know, but sometimes the advocates of higher Pentagon spending sort of make it sound like it's all of a piece. You know, if you cut $1 from the Pentagon budget, you're undermining the troops. And I think that's kind of a bit of a shell game, you know, sort of using the troops and their needs as a rationale for spending that really has nothing to do with helping them.
The city of Battle Creek and the Air National Guard base there specifically is under consideration for a missile defense system. How does that fit in, the idea of missile defense, with this idea of the military-industrial complex?
Well, it's been a huge money source for the corporations ever since Ronald Reagan gave his famous Star Wars speech in the 1980s. And it's been humming along at about $10 billion a year in recent years, so going back quite a while. And that's, if you take those programs all as one, that's one of the biggest weapons investments in the whole portfolio of the Pentagon. And now there's talk of increases. So, for example, they made an interim budget deal that kept almost everything else at a status quo level until they make the bigger agreement, you know, which should happen soon. But they added $5 billion for missile defense, primarily driven by concerns about North Korea, but also now there's a talk of an East Coast missile defense system that would be to deal with the case of Iran if they ever were to develop a missile that could reach the United States.
And is there really a good reason to believe that a missile defense system would be effective if someone were to fire a missile at the United States?
There hasn't been a good track record. You know, they haven't done very much realistic testing. But when they have done that, where there's, you know, you allow the adversary to use things like decoy warheads, and also when you aren't given like an exact time when the launch is going to happen and so forth, the record is fairly poor. If you have sort of a very structured test, some would even call it rigged, where you know exactly when the thing's going to be fired, you know its trajectory, it's a single item that has to be hit, and you send multiple interceptors after it, the record is slightly better. But, you know, most scientists who are not on the payrolls of companies that benefit from the spending have argued that it's, by and large, a poor investment. Some of the regional systems that are for shorter-range missiles have done slightly better, but it almost gives one a false sense of security, because in a real situation, there's a good chance that it wouldn't work. And if you are banking on that it is going to work, you may not structure your Pentagon spending or your strategy in the way that you might need to if you had a more honest assessment of what's likely to happen, even with the missile defense system.
You mentioned earlier that President Trump had promoted the idea of increased military spending as an economic tool. Is there something to that, that some places with military installations rely on that as a way to provide jobs, not just, you know, the people who work at the base, but, you know, they have to go somewhere and, you know, have lunch and buy groceries and that sort of thing. Is there some sort of economic multiplier that comes from military facilities?
Yes, and it's especially strong in areas where it's a big part of the local economy. You know, if there aren't a lot of other options for employment, then it's an outsized influence. And I think, you know, the thing is, almost any other form of public investment creates more jobs than Pentagon spending. There was a study from the University of Massachusetts that found infrastructure spending would create 1.5 times as many jobs as weapons spending. Likewise with spending on alternative energy, education, about twice as many jobs. So there's other ways to create jobs, but there's two kind of problems. One is, would those jobs be if there's a shift from Pentagon spending to other kinds of investments, would those jobs be in the areas that are losing that spending, you know, or would they be left out to dry in a sense? And then the other thing is, how do you get the federal government to invest in other kinds of, you know, needs? And in the current deadlock in Washington, it's hard to get that to happen. And even President Trump's infrastructure plan, which was supposed to be $1 trillion, has not materialized.
So, of course, we're in an election year, and there's some talk that it could turn out to be a pretty good year for Democrats. If there is a so-called wave and there are a whole bunch of Democrats elected to Congress, would you expect that to change in any significant way the amount of money spent on the defense budget or the amount of money spent on arms sales and those sort of things?
Not automatically. A lot of Democrats, because they have bases or factors in their districts, support fairly robust Pentagon spending. And the argument most recently has been, well, if you're going to lift the caps on the Pentagon, you should also lift the caps on domestic spending. So they want more domestic investment. You know, the Democrats are a part of this debate, but they haven't automatically said that we need to cut the Pentagon. But I think in order to get that balance and have more domestic investments, you would need to moderate Pentagon spending somewhat, but it wouldn't automatically be anything like major cuts, you know, just as it was quite robust under President Obama. So I think, you know, for that to happen, for there to be a scaling back, there would have to be a sense that it's something that the public cares about, and not just in a general way, but thinks is a policy that they would, you know, push the government to undertake. Because if it's just kind of, you know, you do a poll and people think, well, yeah, maybe a little less would be fine, maybe we're just right. But unless it's something that people are thinking about and writing about and talking about and, you know, nudging their Congress member about, then it may not have much effect politically, in which case we're kind of on autopilot, maybe with some moderate changes.
And what do you think it would take for the issue of military spending to be a little more front and center, to be the sort of thing that maybe got people showing up at a town hall meeting or something like that to discuss it with their congressman?
Well, I think, you know, this year will be an interesting case because, you know, the next big item on the agenda is going to be possible cuts in programs like Medicare, Social Security, Medicaid. And those are very popular programs that affect people across the spectrum and also across the whole range of of incomes. So past efforts to cut those programs have not been successful by and large. And if it's posed as, you know, we're ramping up the Pentagon dramatically and we're going after these popular programs that a lot of people depend on, either to stay out of poverty or to have a decent middle class lifestyle, then I think the issue might be joined more enthusiastically by some folks. And then in the progressive movements, which have grown under Trump, there's a new initiative. Reverend William Barber, who led the Moral Mondays movement in North Carolina, which pushed back against some of the changes there to things like voting rights and transgender rights and so forth, and was successful in a significant degree, wants to do a national campaign modeled on the one that Martin Luther King was pushing at the end of his life that would look at the issues of racial justice, militarism, poverty, and he would add for the current era, environmental protection and restoration. So if that campaign were to get off the ground and involve some of the existing and growing movements, then Pentagon spending would be a plank of the progressive agenda and part of a growing movement. So, you know, it's not clear at this early date whether that will in fact happen, but there's an opening there.
Bill Hartung is the director of the Arms and Security Project at the Center for International Policy. Thank you very much for your time.
Yes, thank you.
He will speak on Wednesday night in the chapel room at First Congregational Church in Kalamazoo. That event is sponsored by Kalamazoo Nonviolent Opponents of War. Links with more details about that event and to some of Bill Hartung's writing can be found at WMUK.org. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. In the fall, I sat down with Kalamazoo Public Library Director Ryan Weber. He started that job on August 1st. A version of this interview originally aired in October. Ryan Weber, thank you for being with us.
You're welcome, and it's great to be here.
So tell us a little bit about yourself. Where did you grow up?
Sure. I grew up in Lansing. My family is originally from the Clinton County area. I have a lot of family in St. John's, and even before then, folks came from Westphalia and Fowler area.
And where'd you go to college?
I attended Lansing Community College for a couple years, and then I transferred to Western Michigan, where I got a degree in public history, and then discovered that I couldn't get a job or the career path that I wanted with just my degree in public history, but I was motivated at archival work and found out that if I got a library science degree, I could further enhance my future career and look towards a path that would lead me to museum work or archives work. So I went to Wayne State and got a library science degree.
At what point did you figure out that actually what you wanted to do was work at libraries?
Well, I have to admit, it wasn't working in a public library that kind of led me to this field. It was that track of, you know, getting my archival administration background and education at a library science program. And in Wayne State and the U of M here in Michigan both have great programs that develop that interest for people. And I started out my career working at the Detroit Institute of Arts as a librarian, but it was in a special library, and there was a lot of work in archives, archival management there. And then that led me to Cranbrook Educational Community in Bloomfield Hills, where I was an archivist there for a few years. But what happened was our family was growing. My wife and I, we were expecting our third child, and at that point, we were far from home, far from Lansing, or my wife is from the Kalamazoo area, and we wanted to get back over to this side of the state. And I decided at that point, and that was in the winter of 1999, and I remember that winter very well because it was a bad one in terms of storms and heavy snow, and living over on the east side of the state, we just all of a sudden became we were wishing to come back and be closer to family. So at that point, I was ready to take any job, and I started looking at library jobs and soon discovered that the Otsego District Library was looking for a new director. And I applied, I got that job, and my first day working there as director was my first day working in a public library.
I think people will find it interesting that a harsh winter got you to move to West Michigan, where the winters actually tend to be a little bit harsher.
That's true. I hadn't thought of that. But yeah, that was one of the components that drove us to want to come home, was the repercussions of that particular winter and the fact that our third child was on its way.
Your background, as you mentioned, is in history. And I wonder if you see public libraries playing a maybe larger role in preserving local history and kind of keeping that record of what has happened in a community.
Yeah, and maybe you know, maybe you don't, but we have an excellent resource at the Kalamazoo Public Library, our local history department, named after the Clarence Miller family, is a tremendous resource. And it's known widely, not just here in Southwest Michigan, but I believe across the Midwest and even the country, in terms of, again, our staffing and the history behind how that all came about. And in terms of, we have a wonderful historical legacy here in Kalamazoo and Kalamazoo County, and being closely associated with a university environment, we have a lot of records and a lot of families who have contributed to the local history collections here at the Kalamazoo Public Library. But our resource on the second floor at the downtown central branch is used quite a bit, and it's not only something that you can use in person, but it receives heavy usage on our website.
How important are some of the events that the library does, such as reading together, or sometimes having authors come and visit and talk about their books, some of the family events you have? How important are those for, as you say, trying to be that resource in the community that people turn to?
Very important. It's not only a way to get people into the library to see what we do and see what the library provides for their tax dollars, but it is a way that it reinforces what libraries are all about. And I mentioned the fact that we provide a great service in terms of our outreach efforts, in terms of our collections. But libraries today, through their programming efforts, have become bigger and more reliable community resources, community centers, where it's a place where you can go and use one of our spaces to quietly study, or maybe not so quietly study if you want to have a group homework assignment collaboration effort, or share ideas. And that's what oftentimes our programs lead to. It's a sharing of ideas and discussing relevant topics, anything that's current. And it's not only the libraries or the library that brings in authors or different events. It's our community partners and our residents who have great ideas for worthwhile programs.
If we're looking at the future of public libraries, do you have a sense of what the next big thing is?
Yeah, I think that it's still important for us to make sure that we reach as many people as possible. Where our library system here in Kalamazoo is well supported, not only through our residents' taxpayer dollars, but I hear every day from patrons, people I meet, colleagues, how well folks love their Kalamazoo Public Library, but we know we're not reaching everybody. We know that there are still a lot of people who would never consider coming into one of our branches. And to me, that's a big motivator. And we need to work on removing barriers as well. There are still a lot of reasons why those families don't step foot in the library, whether it's cultural or language differences or the fear of owing money, large sums of money if they have outstanding long-term fine balances. We need to find ways to convince our local residents why it's important that we see them back in the library, because we want them in the library, and we're a welcoming place.
Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Ryan Weber became director of the Kalamazoo Public Library on August 1st, A version of that interview originally aired in October. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.